You're listening to the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirk Wood Bromley.
So, welcome to the Inverse Theater Podcast. This episode is the second time I interviewed my friend and director, collaborator, Howard Thorson. I said a lot about Howard in the first episode that I interviewed him in. He's directed quite a few of my plays. I would call him the primary director of my work. Some things I forgot to mention in the last introduction, Howard's done a lot of writing about my work. He's a really great writer. He's incredibly thorough and scholarly when it comes to doing my plays. For instance, he directed The Death of Don Flagrante Delicto, and he actually assembled a glossary of terms for the cast to help them understand the language in the play. It was a beautiful document, and it was a huge help to such a complicated text. He is the executive director of the New York Zen Center, and I know he's done a lot of writing for the Roshi there. He's written an introduction to my plays. His writing has always been something I've cherished. He has an amazing book collection. Yeah, so this is my second talk with Howard. He is a really amazing director. I would say that his great strength as a director is untapping an actor's potential. He works in a very subtle, fluid, generous way with actors and encourages them to find their approach and run with it. And this leaves his productions feeling very organic and fluid and wise and thorough and rehearsed. Howard's often said that, you know, all you need to do a play is a little stage and some people to watch. I think that comes from his history of doing the Portland Shakespeare out in the parks, which is what he did before he came to New York in the mid-70s. So his approach to theater is very pure. It's almost from another age. It's just actors singing their lines, having fun, sharing a public experience with an audience through story and language. And that's what he brought to my plays, and I'll always be grateful for him. So here's episode two of my discussion with Howard Thorson, and I do hope to do a third one.
Beautiful. It was long, I think. Like the midwife said, it was long. Probably 36 hours, maybe, of induction. And then apparently we pushed for a lot longer than normal. I mean, long story short, she was pushing for like 3 hours with the midwife, and then the OBGYN came in, and she seemed like a woman who had been like delivering babies on Mexican oil rigs all her life. And she was really tough and direct. And she was like, most people push for an hour. I'm not going to let you push much longer because otherwise I'm going to have to do an emergency C-section on you. And we don't want that. So you've got a little bit more time to get this baby out and left the room. And so we went into crack mode, and I became a birthing coxswain, and we started just breathing and pushing and breathing and pushing. And we pushed for an hour, another hour. So that's 4 hours. And back in came the doctor, and she said, "You did it," because she could start seeing the baby's head. So pushed some more, and then at about 4.5 hours, she stuck a vacuum tube on top of his head and pulled him right out with one tug. Wow. So, yeah. And I was crying and I fell to my knees and kissed her feet. And she was in the midwife the next day that they were texting all day about how for in 30 years of working at birds, they had never seen anybody drop their knees and kiss their feet. And so I guess I'm known for something. It was that kind of, you know, it was coming. I don't know what the phase is. It was like tense for quite a while because the baby's heart rate was dropping. Leah got a fever. She got an infection, all while pushing. And the doctor is saying the baby might go down too far to do a C-section, and then we're screwed. And so it was high drama for like 3.5 hours. But the baby came out and was in awesome shape. And the mother is pretty pretty wrecked up, but she is recovering. And so, yeah, everything's good and beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. He's doing great. He loves the boob. He's boobing all the time and nonstop. And so that part, which can be so difficult, has proven to be pretty cool and good. And so yeah, we're having a beautiful time. It's lovely. She feeds him all night long, and then I get up and I walk around with him for hours while she gets her sleep. Uh-huh. And so that's a beautiful time. We do a lot of morning walks, him and me, and yard work and listening to music and hanging out and just trying to stretch out as much time as we can of him off the booby. The booby, uh-huh. Uh-huh. The booby becomes necessary, so we go back to the booby. So it's back and forth with the boob. But, you know, we're getting out a little bit. We went to a little party the other night, and he was good. We wore him, and he was cool. So yeah, it's been lovely. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. However, you're right. It's been 2 weeks. You and I were supposed to talk last week, but we didn't yeah, talk because I was.
Yeah.
But I'm getting back in the swing of things. I mean, it's 2 weeks out, so I figure life should continue, right?
He's on his own.
Yeah, exactly. No, I gave him his luggage in the morning, and he's gone. Yeah. It was awesome. How have you been?
I've been good.
What kind of babies did you have in the last 2 weeks?
What kind of babies? This morning we had I think I've told you before at the Zendo once or twice a year we have a thing where a senior student. A person becomes a senior student and they give their first talk and they do something called Dharma Combat where people ask them questions, they have to respond. And this was a really beautiful guy who he's a musician and a sound engineer. And but he also went to Southeast Asia and lived in Buddhist monasteries and traveled around. So he's a really, seems like a pretty young guy, but maybe 30-ish, that has a rich experience, give a good talk, give good answers. And when you said the thing about kissing the feet, they have to do some real prostrations to the teacher. So that was my image of you kissing the
the teacher. Yeah. They built real prostrations, not like... You mean just like lots of them, or they need to be very sincere, or are they judged for their frustrations?
Nah, I don't think anybody is judged, but they're it's just a little thing you do. There's a lot of things in threes in Zen because you know, comedy happens in threes, and so there's three bows to the teacher and three bows to each side of the Zendo, each group of people. Sometimes.
Hmm.
Some extra bows to the family is there. This guy's family were there, but they're not speaking to each other, so we have them all seated in a row together, but they didn't look at each other. So that was one birthing. I went to the theater last night. I saw Hamlet by the Ostermeyer, you know, his
No,
know, a few years ago, did I excitedly send you stuff about his Richard III? They did a Richard III that I just found fantastic, just amazing. The Hamlet, a little bit more mixed. But he has a great actor, Lars Eidinger. He's great, but in this Hamlet, he wore a fat suit and he danced around.
I've seen photos of this.
Yeah, some of it was really good, but it just felt a little bit like a parody of German avant-garde. Like stuff we've seen before. You know, well done, but stuff we've seen a long time ago before.
Mm.
Nonetheless, this is what I thought, Kirk. I thought during the play, it was all, you know, changed around and everything different. And there were only six actors and people rolling in the dirt, eating dirt and all this. But I thought, what a fantastic play this is. And I thought, I hope in 400 years I could go to a production of one of your plays like this and hear the play as clearly as I did this 400-year-old play. Even though they were doing all kinds of stuff, they were trying to do all kinds of stuff to it, I could still hear the play.
That's sweet.
That was my thought about you. And my theater going in 400 years.
Yeah. That's sweet. But where did they do the, when you say they move things around, do you mean they moved, they changed the text around or?
Yeah, they had a lot of video and it started off with a video of, the concept was kind of that Hamlet was always crazy. He was kind of crazy and that the visions of the ghost and everything are produced by his craziness over the death of his father. I had a friend who was in a production years ago at the Seattle Rep. He was playing Claudius, and the director had the idea that Hamlet was crazy and that everybody thinks he's crazy. And this guy said, how can you play Claudius if you think Hamlet is crazy? You have nothing to contrast with.
Yeah.
So he said he and the guy who played Hamlet, basically kind of they had a scene where they were eating peanuts and they threw the peanuts on the floor and saw who could step on them. And they kind of opted out because of this. And I felt it lost kind of the, I mean, the play's 400 years old and it's done every day, so I don't care what you really. You can do anything that you want, but it didn't. For me, it didn't cohere. And part of it is, I believe in that play, the first thing you see is the ghost with other people who are not Hamlet seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's a world in which ghosts exist. But he's
the way they've done it, the way they move things around made it seem as if the ghost could just be a figment of his insanity.
Yeah, but there's some wonderful things in it, and they had, the whole front of the stage was covered with dirt, and they had started off with the burial of Hamlet the father, and there was a kind of a comic gravedigger who was trying to put the coffin down into the earth by himself, and he couldn't, and it kept falling around, and he kept falling into the grave. And they cut the gravedigger scene, but they put in the comedy there. One thing when he says, when he comes up with the idea of the play within a play, he said, I've heard that, I can't remember the exact line, but I've heard this guilty person sitting at a play and they brought up the lights in the audience. And then he pointed to somebody and he said, you look guilty. Why don't you stand up? Let everybody see what a guilty person looks like. So this poor woman stood up. And when the play started, oh no, when the fencing match started, he went out and sat in the audience like he was going to sit and watch the match himself. There's a lot of playing around that was fun. Anyway.
That's good. That's fun.
So anyway, I got to the theater because I wanted to see this guy and this actor.
Yeah. Is the theater kicking and hopping and bouncing again?
Yeah, apparently so. Although, I mean, this was at the Harvey, you know, out of BAM.
Yeah.
And I would say in a normal circumstance, it would be completely sold out. And there were still not a huge number of empty seats, but a middling number.
Yeah.
And I have some friends that went to a couple of Broadway shows last week, and they said the audience was good, but they went on the half price tickets and they got like front row mezzanine or fourth row
orchestra. Yeah.
So it's still a little bit.
Give us a little encapsulation of your Zendo thing. What are you at the Zendo? What do you do there? What have you been doing there?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have the title executive director of the Village Zendo. It's basically administrative stuff that I do. I organize programs. I answer emails. I set up semi-annual fundraisers. This week, I waited around for 3 days while we got the front door fixed with workmen coming late, coming early, and generally I do a monthly newsletter and a weekly reminder. I've edited 3 books by the Roshi, and I'm working on a fourth one.
You're an official there. You're the executive director. And did you start as the executive director? Like, was that like, or were you practicing there and then that developed?
Yeah, I practiced there, I think, for maybe, I might have practiced there for 10 years with not too many duties. I did some beginning instruction because it was basically because I sat on Monday nights, and that's when they did beginning instruction. And after the teachers got to know me, they assigned me that task of giving instruction. Mm-hmm. And then a few years into it, the person who was the executive director at the time asked me if I could be kind of like an assistant and take over some tasks to relieve him of the tasks. So I started doing that, and I've done that for at least 10 years, maybe longer, but maybe 5 years ago I became the official executive director.
When did you start? Was the Village Zendo your first Zendo, like to go and sit?
I sat at a couple of Zendos before, but I didn't. I just was in and out. You know, I came in for the sittings and left at the end. I didn't become part of the community. So this is the first one. My sister is a Zen Buddhist, and when she officially there's a ceremony where you officially become a Buddhist, which is called taking the precepts. You take the basic 10 commandments of Buddhism. And she wanted me to come. She's in Los Angeles. She wanted me to come, and I couldn't for some reason. I was probably doing a play with you or something. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'll find a Zen center in New York, and I'll sit there this weekend, you know, kind of in honor of you. And so I went to 2 or 3 Zendos for a little while, of finding that I liked it, but I didn't know which one I would end up at. But the Village Zendo was the closest one, and I ended up going there.
Mm. And how did you transition from being like a yoga guy to a Zen guy?
As I've told you before, when I was a kid, this was all kind of new. This was the pre-60s. So there was kind of Eastern religion. It was all kind of new to the general public anyway. And there was Alan Watts was a popularizer. He, at that time, that ancient world of the early 1960s, people used to read something called books. And it used to be that many, many, many people of various social classes would be reading the same kind of books. They felt some of high literary quality and some of not so high. And Alan Watts was a popularizer of the writing of D.T. Suzuki on Zen, but he had a wonderful kind of easy, friendly, humorous way of speaking that communicated these ideas directly to a Western audience. And so he kind of blended the ideas of Hinduism and Buddhism together. And then when I went to college, I studied with a major Buddhist scholar, Edward Kanza, who was the first translator of the Prajnaparamita literature, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. I also would say I was a yoga meditator, but as I meditated, you know, I got into meditation thinking that it was going to make me wise and in control, and sort of masterfully in control of myself and my thoughts and my actions and the physical world. Who knows what I thought? But as I practiced more meditation, the less and less of control I felt, and the more I felt like I was coming apart rather than solidifying. And Buddhism seemed a more accurate reflection of my meditation experience. So I kind of veered in that direction, even though I didn't get into an official Buddhist world till I was in my early 30s. So,
I find it fascinating that how is yoga meditation or Hinduism different from Buddha meditation or Buddhism, and are they different, and what's the, not only in your experience, but I guess you know the literature so well, like, are they canonically different?
Yeah, I mean, the Buddhism, I wouldn't say it distinguishes itself, but Buddha, if he actually existed, the character of Buddha in history, rejected an essential element of Indian thought, I would say, which was that there is a real self, that there's kind of an absolute self that is your true self. There's a universal self, which is a Brahman or God, you could say, a transcendent self. And then there's an individual self, kind of like our idea of the soul, but then at the heart of it, it's identical to the absolute self. So people talk about it in different ways, you know, like a spark of the divine inside, or, you know, part. But it has to do with an existent being, the absolute being, that's the root of all existence. Buddhism says that if you examine the self, you find that there's nothing there. There's not a absolute. In fact, there's change. There's only changing. And
can you quickly break down that those kinds of selves again? What are those? Were there three of them or two of them? Or, and we're talking about Buddhism here, right?
About Hinduism or Indian thought. I mean,
Indian thought.
Yeah, Hinduism.
So there was sure. Great. List those three selves again.
Well, there's the absolute. There's the absolute self. They, in Western writing, anyway, they you cap self with a capital S. That's the absolute being. And that it has three characteristics: existence, knowledge, and bliss. So absolute existence, absolute knowledge, and absolute bliss. It's kind of a beautiful idea to me that at the base of everything is bliss, it's this joy, and that creation comes out of this, out of joy, knowledge, and it manifests as an individual has a center that is like this. So I would say the idea in Hinduism or in most yoga, not all, but most yoga is you see the change, the sort of change that Buddhism talks about, this fluctuation of mind, but there's an underlying that you see it against, like the figures moving on a movie screen. You see it against the screen, but there's actually the light, there's actually the screen underneath this. And the individual soul, if you will, is actually identical with the universal soul. How that works out is the subject of endless scriptures and debates and commentaries and philosophic exploration. But that's kind of in simple terms, that's kind of what it is.
So there's not three. There's the absolute self and the individual self.
Yeah.
So maybe I see. And the goal of yoga is to realize their unity or their identity, or to wake up to it, or practice enough to make it happen, or see right to uncover it, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's various ways, they call them ways, that you can achieve or attain this oneness. And so a person who is devotional might be devoted to a god or to an ideal or to a teacher. And this devotion brings them out of themselves, enlarges the self to a greater extent. Somebody who's philosophic will, in a kind of a traditional way, there's something called Jnana Yoga, the yoga of wisdom, where that's a process of denial. It's not this, it's not that, not this, not that. Anything that you examine, it's not that. That's very Buddhist in a way, but in the Hindu idea, at the bottom of it, you find something, there is something real, there's a solid reality. The practice of yoga that we all know, the physical practice of the postures and everything, is also a way of awakening. And there are other ways with chanting, mantras, yogic occult anatomy, the kundalini that rises through the spine, and so forth. And there's a lot, of course, in India, there's not exactly a pope. There are some high guys, but there's not the sort of central organization. So all these different gurus have, in a way, invented their own religions, which are a mishmash of all these different things.
And you transmigrated out of this structure into Zen, or what happened?
Yeah, well, like I said, it's what Buddhism says in a nutshell, I guess what I would say is there's all these fluctuations that you observe, that one observes, and one observes they call it turning the light around. If you turn the light around on the observer, you see that also is fluctuating. And in fact, everything is fluctuating. So there's no bottom to it. That came, people talk about in Buddhism, no self, no, it doesn't mean you don't exist, but it means that you don't exist in the way that you assume you do, which is a solid thing that that can, has continuity. You exist as a pattern, like an eddy in a river, as a river edge. It looks like it's the same thing, but it's different water constantly. Right. It actually is changing. That turned out to be my experience of myself in meditating. Mm. Mm. I've spent a lot of time exploring the teachings of Krishnamurti, who was a Buddhist, but not officially no religion.
Mm.
There's a section of Hinduism which is very close, Advaita Vedanta, the end of that's very close to Buddhism and its exploration too. So I just found this was what made sense to my experience, and the idea of this solid self or this bliss self, it was more connected to something that I was trying to make happen rather than what I was actually exerting and experiencing.
And so you happened upon Zen or the Zendo and sitting and Zen meditation, and that felt kind of like a little more true to your experience or a little more satisfying?
Yeah, even when I was very young, like I said, we had Alan Watts. He was basically, people said anyway, he was basically taking the more scholarly popularization by D.T. Suzuki and making it even more popular, making it available to all kinds of people. And there's his message continues on practically everybody that I meet that's involved in yoga or Buddhism has some experience of Alan Watts and his.
Yeah.
So even now, but in the 50s and 60s, he was like a guy that people like my parents, everybody was reading Alan Watts.
Sure.
So that was
yeah.
The stuff that was coming out during the hippie era was a mix because there was the gurus from India, but there were also the Tibetan Buddhists who made a big splash at that time. Famous people like Chogyam Trungpa, who again kind of broke through to a popular audience, almost maybe. Some of the big beatniks, Allen Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, maybe most of the beatnik poets were very influenced by Buddhism or were actual Buddhist practitioners. Gary Snyder spent time in a monastery in Japan and was a serious Zen student. Jack Kerouac, I've just been reading about him in a book about the beatniks, and that he had a pretty deep understanding of Buddhism at the time.
Go ahead.
I was discovering it at that time, not just later.
Yeah.
I just didn't, partly because of my practice with my interest in Krishnamurti, who rejected all religions. I had the idea that it was important not to identify yourself with a particular religion. And in fact, I've never taken the Buddhist precepts, even though I'm the executive director of the Zen temple.
Yeah, tell us what are the Buddhist precepts and what's the normal trajectory of someone through the Zendo, in the sense that, because I know that you have not done any of that, the koans and the moving up in the hierarchy or the education aspect or the so what's the normal arc in the goal of understanding what you have not done?
Yeah, so if a person comes to the Zen Center, if they come fresh, nobody comes fresh anymore, because whenever I ask what's your experience about meditation, they say, "Well, I have an app. I've tried an app, or I've tried several apps." So that meditation is available in these apps or online. There's all kinds of ways. But the general idea is, if you came in with no idea and just want to learn to meditate or whatever, you get some basic instruction in how to sit, what to do, how to look at your mind, how to observe yourself, and so forth. And maybe a couple of mental exercises or just a little bit of study. And you practice, usually maybe you practice for a year or two. A student in the village Zendo, he might come to the Zendo once or twice a week to practice with other people. A sincere student would set up a home practice of some kind, sitting for half an hour or an hour a day. And then once a month, there's an all-day practice period. And twice a year, there's a week-long or longer period of practice. And a student in the trajectory, a student is expected to come to the Zendo at least once a week, to come to these monthly all-day practices, and to come to at least one of the long periods of sitting, at least a week of that. And also, there's a practice of meeting with the teacher, and that is...
That's the koans, right?
Well, it initially can just be meeting with it and talking about your practice, talking about your life, talking about what your understanding is. It doesn't have to be the koans. It's very individual. And you meet with the teacher usually just about 10 minutes at a time or something. But over time, it becomes a significant relationship. And the teacher can give you suggestions or practices other than the kind of fundamental practices of sitting, meditation, suggestions for things you might do. And they also can give you koans. So the koans are these stories and statements. Most of them come from our Chinese heritage, which is Buddhism came into China about 400 AD, maybe, and through the connection with Chinese thought is kind of how Zen happened, the meeting of this kind of intellectual Zen, intellectual Buddhism, and Chinese Taoism. Zen was created, I would say. So in those early days, there were lots of masters who had they rejected the idea that you should try to find out what it was that the Buddha was teaching or try to attain the state of Buddhahood, which was kind of what had happened to Buddhism in the 1,000 years of practice and commentaries and so forth. And they said you should have your own awakening. And in order to encourage this, they engaged in slapping, shouting, killing animals, all kinds of things to shock you out of your regular state of mind. And these stories were gathered about them, and various collections of stories were made. And later,
so the koans are kind of they originated in China.
Most of
kind of a record of the Chinese experience, yeah.
Yeah. Later on, when Zen came to Japan and was codified in Japan, some of the Japanese teachers there are koans about now. Sure. And there have been, various stories. Even in the Zendo, there might be some stories that circulate that kind of have the idea of koans. Some teachers use things from modern literature, poetry, Alice in Wonderland.
The
idea of a koan is it at least one idea of it, there's many, one idea of it is it challenges your habitual thinking. So if you really...
Yeah, but tell us the Koan experience one would have with the teacher if you're a student.
Yeah. Traditionally, the idea is the teacher gives you a koan, and there are two koans that are kind of the standard first koan. One is called Mu. A student sincerely asks a teacher, does this dog have Buddha nature? This dog. A dog in the Chinese society at the time was kind of the lowest level of being, you know. It's like a swami I once knew said the highest birth that you could get was to be a dog in America. And the lowest level of birth you could get was to be a dog anywhere else in the world. And so it's a truism in Buddhism that all sentient beings have Buddha nature. All sentient beings have the potential to be awakened Buddhas. So the questioner is asking, does this dog have Buddha nature? And the teacher answers, moo, which essentially means no, but it also means there's another version of it where he says woo, which means yes. So the answer is really, it could be anyway, one way that you could interpret the answer is this does not apply, this is not a question. Shut up. And so a person is asked to meditate on this, and they often struggle with it for a long time. Because what does it mean? What is the teacher getting at, and what is the dog and all that? You might... One way a person might think of it is, it's an abstract as a story about a dog, but maybe I feel like I'm a dog. I don't, these other people that I admire, that seem good, that seem wise and so forth, they have, obviously have Buddha nature, but I don't. Other people are worthy of love, but I am not.
Right.
And,
so is the goal for the student to, is the student supposed to say something about the koan to the teacher that is then approved or disapproved, or what's...
Yeah, so what happens is you go into the teacher, and in the traditional idea about this, you go in and you present your answer, you present your response. Another way that they say it is you demonstrate your understanding. So it's not really saying what this means, thus and such. It's illustrating that somehow you have got the point of this, as if you were the questioner and the answerer. They say when you find the correct response to a koan, they say it's like you're mingling your eyebrows with the ancient master.
It's like threading your eyebrows into theirs.
Yeah, you're really joining their mind. You're joining this club,
right? But there's no right or wrong answer. There's no established answer. There's no written answer.
Exactly.
And so when you mingle your eyebrows with the ancients, you have an answer that makes, well, it might make you feel like you're aligning with the agents, but your teacher needs to agree. Is that right?
Yeah. In this kind of traditional setup, the teacher says, go back and go deeper, or or, mm-hmm. or no, or, you know, don't bother mm-hmm. me, or they turn their back on you. Various mm-hmm. ways of saying that you have to go on. Your understanding is intellectual, or it's incomplete, or it's weak. Mm. The mu koan is, for most people, that's kind of the beginning koan. That's the one you have to break through. Might take a few years to break through it. But the other one, the alternate one, is show me your original face before your parents were born. So you could ask your...
That's the koan. That's the koan.
Yeah.
So it's like it's an order. Show me, like, it's an imperative.
Yeah.
Show me your original face before your parents were born. That's the koan.
Yeah.
And then the student is supposed to give a response to that.
Yeah. And it's somehow to demonstrate that you have understood something. It's not an intellectual exercise. There are lots of commentaries on these by the Zen masters for the last 1,000 years. and some of them are very, they're poems written. When you have passed the koan, so to speak, when the teacher feels that your understanding is complete, you're still not done. You still have to answer many questions about it. And those questions are kind of functional, like, you understand that the dog has Buddha nature or doesn't have Buddha, whatever it is you understand about the dog, but what about a ship at sea? What about a person that's being buried alive? What about a high castle? What about a soldier in war? What? You have to demonstrate that in 1,000 different ways you see this thing. So theoretically, if you make a breakthrough in this way, you have a kind of an understanding that's unshakable. You know, that you've seen something so clearly. But in fact, there are hundreds of koans, and the idea, I don't do that kind of koan practice, but the people that do, in each kind of school of Zen, there's different sets of koans, and you have to pass through, in our school, I think 750 koans. So it's a serious study. It takes a long time. And you're looking at things from many different angles, many different... what I've done, I first encountered koans in the 60s. There was a translation of major text by a guy named Paul Reps, who was in the group with Alan Watts and those people, but he had a kind of an independent existence. He kind of wandered around the world giving talks here and there and writing little books. He wrote a book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, which, again, it was popular in a way that I don't know if any book is anymore. Maybe Harry Potter, but for adults. A book that lots and lots and lots of people read. And oddly, and it was a collection of koans, mostly, 50 koans, I think, or maybe 100, without any explanations, without commentaries. And so we just, in those days, we read these things and thought, one koan might be, step off a 100-foot pole, or another koan that I have often referred to is a man is being pursued by a tiger. He falls off a cliff and he grabs onto a root of a tree that's sticking out, under this cliff like they do, and he's holding onto it, and he looks down and there's another tiger below him. And so he's hanging there by his fingers and the branch begins to be pulling out, and he sees a strawberry, and he eats it. He says, oh, what a delicious strawberry. Or in another similar case, he's hanging there between the two tigers, and the teacher says, now you're in this situation, say a true word. So the person has to, you know, engage in an imaginative exercise, like an actor, identify completely and put themselves in this situation, which maybe maybe you are in your life at all times. But
yeah.
It's a little goad.
Yeah, that's so okay. Yeah, I want to go there in just a second. So why haven't you done koans?
Well, as I said, I got very involved in the teachings of Krishnamurti, who rejected all this. Although he himself, people used to call him the guru of no gurus. You know, he I was also influenced by the de-schooling society movement. Ivan Illich was a famous guy in the 60s who wrote a book called De-Schooling Society. And I felt that I didn't want to be in a situation where somebody was telling me whether I had an insight or not. I respect this tradition. I find it, you can tell the way I talk about it. I find it interesting, compelling in a way. Because I encountered these koans when I was very young. They've sat in me for 60 years or something, and I've thought of them many times in certain situations they arise. I've taken classes where in groups we examine them, read a lot. But I didn't like the idea. I don't like the idea of any kind of teaching that is evaluating a person as a being. I like the idea of teaching somebody to be a doctor and showing them how to do something and failing them if they are incompetent. Learning Spanish, I believe there's authority in that way, but I don't believe anybody can tell you how to be a human being or whether you understand something deep about yourself or not. And I don't think that people should be doing that. So my engagement in the Zen Center, the village Zendo, I always say my dedication is practice. The practice of sitting meditation is really, and my kind of faith in it, and my belief that it is good to have a place where you practice with other people that is centered around that practice. But I don't really, and my idea is not to preserve this kind of Japanese Zen, which is different from Chinese Zen, which is different from Vietnamese Zen.
Anyway. Yeah. I seem to remember that the Roshi asked you once what your practice was.
Is that a story that I told? Cool. Yeah, the Roshi asked me what my practice was, and I said, when you practice in a center, there's like bells. There's a bell that starts the meditation, a bell that starts the end. And I said, I sit and look at the floor, and when the bell rings, I get up. And she said, that's what I do too, and that's what the Buddhas and the patriarchs all practiced.
Right. So I and yet there's people who practice something else. They practice differently. Their koans are their practice, or which reminds me of the burning house thing. Remember the burning house? What's the burning house story?
Okay, the burning house story is in the Lotus Sutra, the most popular Buddhist scripture in the East, probably. And the story is a very rich man. He has a big mansion, many, many rooms in it, and it catches fire, and he has his children are engaged in their games. Nowadays, a lot of people say they're playing their computer games, and they're so engaged in these games that they are not registering that the building is on fire. And just as a side, the first sermon that the Buddha gave is called Burning, and it's that the world is burning, you know, long before the idea of global warming. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha said, everything is burning, burning, burning. And so this rich man conceives the idea. His children have told him that they admire these chariots, which again, in the modern telling, you might say different kinds of cars, different kinds of sports cars, old jalopies fixed up, different kinds of self-driving cars and so forth. And so he tells his children, each one of them, he tells them he has this kind of chariot outside that he's gotten for them, and he wants to come out. And there's a very narrow exit left because of this burning, and he gets them to come out by enticing them with a story. He gets them to come out. And in fact, he has a chariot there, but it's not the chariot that he's been telling them that he has, the chariot that
he tells, has. And he tells each child, like he lures each child with a different story.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending on the child's kind of fascination, like one child likes muscle cars, one child likes,
new Tesla
electric cars.
Yeah, exactly. So depending on the child's inclination, he tells them, "I've got this for you outside, and you got to come outside now, because you're
right."
And
what's the phrase in Buddhism for this method?
Skillful means.
So in other words, you know, when you're trying to get everybody out of the burning house, you use different means that will speak to them.
Yeah.
To get them up and going. Yeah.
Yeah. In practice, I mean, there are different interpretations of it, but I would just say in practice, what happens is, because there's this one-on-one relationship with the teacher, you talk with the teacher about your feelings, your ideas, your dreams, your what you want to, why you're there, what you're practicing for. And most of us, or all of us, are practicing mostly because we want to enhance ourselves some way. We want to get better. We want to be beautiful. We want to be smart. We want to be loved. We want to be loving. It's all self-improvement. It's all self-help in some way. And that's not really the project of Buddhism. But the teacher says, you can practice this little breathing exercise. You can calm down. There are ways you can become more calm. There are ways that you can become more even. There are ways. It's not so much in Zen, but in other forms of Buddhism, you practice like feeling compassion for your family, and then your friends, and then your city, and then your state, and then your country, and then you expand compassion. Lots and lots of mental exercises you can do that, for the most part, a person feels that they're going to progress. They're going to get better. They're going to get wiser. They're going to get calmer. They're going to have more control over their passions. And then they tell themselves the story that this is happening. And then, then the Zen master will put on a red nose. And
why is that? Because Are you saying that people go to Zen with a kind of motive of self improvement, or
and
Zen is explicitly not that? Like, it's a very important aspect of Zen. It's not about that. So what's it about? Like, why is it important? Why is it important to not be about that? Why do they put on the red nose?
What's up with that? Bernie Glassman Roshi called himself a bodhisattva instead of a bodhisattva. He's a bodhisattva. Anything I say, it will be false, you know. What it's about is, well, we could go back to the story of the Buddha. The story of the Buddha was he was raised in a pleasure palace, which I would say most Americans are. If you look at the rest of the world, anyway, raised in a pleasure palace. And in his early 30s, he encountered life. He encountered sickness, old age, and death, and which is, in a word, suffering. He encountered suffering. And he wanted to end suffering. So that's you could say that's maybe almost a negative way of looking at it. The world is burning. I am burning. You're burning. How do I know you're burning? Because I'm a human being, because I'm burning and I'm suffering. I know that you're suffering too. And so that's, how could this be alleviated or mitigated? How could you lessen the suffering at least a little bit of self and other? And it's not through, at least in the Buddhist project, it's not through getting better. Another way of looking at it is, to me, I use, when I give beginning instruction, I say, look, you have this fantastic opportunity to be, you're alive, you're on a ball of dust flying through space at incomparable speeds, and somehow you're able to know it. You're able to be awake to it. It's incredible. It's impossible. It's uncalled for. It's and yet there it is, and you could appreciate it. And that's a way that I like to look at awakening. Is you can be awake to it for a minute here and there, or longer even. But and that has not to do with being morally upright, with being wise. All these things, being moral, being meditative, being calm, all these things are just fingers pointing at the moon, as they say in Buddhism. They're not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is to be awake, to be ready, to be like the guy with the tiger chasing him, alert, with the senses awake to experience this incredible situation that we're in. And I was going to say something else, but I can't remember what it was.
that was awesome.
I know what I was going to say. If Kirk Bromley wrote a play about you, let's see, if Dostoevsky wrote a novel about you, with all your unhappiness and your masturbation and your confusion and your not having enough money and feeling ugly or whatever it is, you would think, wow, this guy really gets it. He really understands life. What a beautiful novel, what a beautiful play, what a beautiful movie of somebody that really gets it. And yet about ourselves, we think, oh, I shouldn't be that. I should be something else.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you you once I'll make this public. You said to me after 9/11, which we were both in New York during 9/11, you said that people jumping out of those towers would have traded anything for your very worst day. And that really stuck with me. I was reminded of that when you said all that. Yeah. So I think I'd like to try to wonder about theater after all that. And how theater fits in there. And I think maybe instead of abstractly, sort of like, you know, you have practiced all this, what you call Eastern religion, for years and years alongside theater. And, you know, you've told me before that theater is your religion. I'm not quoting you, but you know, maybe I am. I'm not going to put you on the spot about that. But you know, these practices have grown in you over your life in parallel. You'd go from the zendo to rehearsal to the stage to a play to yoga in this circle of life and experience that you were having. I don't know. I guess the question is kind of, well, to start, like, you know, what's do these things work well for you? Like, are they kind of like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for you, or are they one dance and one experience and you feel they really flow together and they inform each other? Is theater your dark, dangerous, weird anti-Zen side, and Zen's your peaceful stop the world burning side, and you kind of jive on having these totally different realities that you can dabble in, or do they unite ideologically through practice? I don't know. Talk a little about that, and then maybe I'll have more specific questions.
Yeah. When I first got involved in yoga, I was in a cult, the Yogananda cult, and it was very purocentric, I say, very, very much about purifying yourself, very much about getting better, and had a kind of a rigid morality about it. And I got involved in yoga and theater approximately the same age. Same time, and I'd done a lot of playing around as a kid in acting kind of classes and things like that. So I knew I wanted to be an actor very young. So it wasn't like I discovered the two at the same time, but I became active at around the age of 13, and. So in some ways, it seemed like there was a difference between the two. Like there was the theater was a kind of a decadent thing going on. But there's also, for instance, in Zen Buddhism, the kind of Zen Buddhism I read about when I was even that young, there was the way of art. There was considered the way of art. In Zen, there's a flower arrangement, there's a tea ceremony, there's archery, there's different kinds of martial arts. They're part of Zen training in Japan, or the training of the art involved a certain amount of meditation. So either coming from one side or the other, it was integrated, and the kind of the acme of art in the Japanese traditions is a kind of a spontaneity that's based on technical mastery and freedom from technical mastery. So I had that idea because I always was a big reader. So I had read about all these things. And as I said, in that time, the late 50s, early 60s, there was a lot of material starting to come out. You know, it was a discovery that many people, you know, mothers from the PTA were taking flower arrangement classes and stuff. You know, it was like a thing. There's something that I haven't explored at all, but I've read the headlines. So there's an interesting thing that is that the Second World War came to an end with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And there's some idea that the embrace of Zen Buddhism by so many young men of that era was connected to that, you know, to almost like a atonement or some kind of wanting to understand this world that they had destroyed. So I don't know any more about it than that, but that's one thing. Anyhow, so I had that idea. And then that idea is not very unique. There's, like in the Indian tradition, the great sagas, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, those are performed all the time, and they're all-night performances. Say, sometimes it's one person tells the story, acts all the parts. Sometimes it's a big production. Sometimes it's a local where people in a community have these roles that they play every year, for years and years. There's all kinds of forms where the religion and performance meet, in a way. And I didn't start off wanting to be a director, but in the some of the early productions that I directed when I was in Portland, a friend of mine who had been growing up in India said that my productions reminded him of the street theater in India, that they had this quality of a little bit, you know, ragtag. Little bit high technical acting or movement, but a little bit of kind of ragtag community thing. So it was partly just that somebody saw me that way that made me think about it. So. And I was also exposed to the teachings of Gurdjieff, the Russian mystic, and he was a performance artist of some kind in his youth, and when he started teaching, he called himself a dancing teacher, and he taught dances that he supposedly had gathered all around the world from mystical traditions, and that were kind of a yogic training, difficult movements that you had to learn how to do. That related to Sufi dancing, the whirling dervishes, and other kinds of Sufi dancing. So all of this, again, it was a very rich period in America, or in Europe, too, where all these things were kind of becoming, you know, and then television was flourishing, and we were seeing things that we had never seen before. There were movies made, sometimes there were movies made just about how things were seen around the world, you know, circuses around the world, eating around the world, different things. So I would say my idea kind of grew out of that that practice. Then, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
Yeah. Grotowski, the Polish Lab Theater. So in Poland, there was this great director, Jerzy Grotowski. And he had been in India. He studied yoga. He studied Gurdjieff. He studied all these things. And he, in Poland at the time, there were huge state subsidies for theater. And he had what was called the Polish Lab Theater, in which he trained. He called it a laboratory, and in it he was training and also exploring theater as a yoga, in a way. And this was around the time when I was stuck in Portland because I was drafted and I had to do my alternate service in Portland. And I had a room and some people who were willing to be my victims and so I pursued some of this exploring. I was out in Portland, Oregon, so I just knew from books. Everything was from books and from the Tulane Drama Review, which reported what was going on in New York and the rest of the world. But I took those
the Tulane Drama Review.
Yeah. You know that.
I mean, I know Tulane. I didn't know they had a drama review. Is it still around?
I believe it's still around, but I think
Yale
or somebody took it over. But
yeah.
It's still called the Tulane Drama Review. They did like a whole issue on Grotowski, and then his book Towards a Poor Theater was published. And then Peter Brook, who is already very famous, became enamored of Grotowski. And so...
Was Grotowski explicitly yoga as theater or yogic theater, or was he a yoga person, or
he had done some? I don't know too much about his training, but he had done enough training. Well, this is a vast ocean.
Yes,
there are these art forms in India, as well as in Japan and China, but in India there are these dance forms connected to these performances about the Hindu scriptures and so forth. And in those forms, they're very explicit. They start training children when they're very young. It's like the Cirque du Soleil. The physical training is intense. It involves not only tremendous physical flexibility and speed and alertness, but also things like eye movements, mastery of the eyes, move the eyes in any direction, and the eyes, if you've seen any Indian theater, you know they can expand their eyes amazingly, facial expressions, bodily movements. So Grotowski, I don't know how much he studied or with whom, but again, he had this state subsidies that the Poland provided at the time for artists, and he was able to study enough that he was able to incorporate some of it. I don't think that he explicitly, he didn't say, I'm doing yoga for theater, but if you look at the movements and the exercises, the breathing exercises, the sort of things they were doing, they were all in the line, in this line
of
exploration of the body.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's awesome. That's where I want to kind of go. Cause I think, you know, I was going to ask you earlier, but I decided to wait, but I'll ask now. You know, not that I'm trying to like start controversy, but I think something that isn't talked a lot about is that Hinduism or Indian thought, as you called it, and Buddhism, and inevitably Zen as a, I don't know, a flowering of Buddhism or an ultimate, a final conclusion of Buddhism, that these traditions are really actually super in their core goal. That Indian thought's goal is to unite the universal with the individual self, or the individual self with the universal self, to work toward that unification. And Buddhism was a schism or a Protestantism coming out of that tradition, where it said that project is futile because there is no individual self. So trying to mesh it with the universal self is a fantasy, and it's not going to happen. And so what gets called just Eastern thought, or, you know, Eastern religion now, kind of clouds those two very in a sense, opposed projects. And then you have theater. And so it's a big question, but so tell me, Howard, because you're the only person who can answer this. The goal of Indian thought states that the ultimate mystic or self-realizing goal is the unification of the individual with the absolute self. Zen's goal, I'm still unclear about, and theater's goal, I definitely don't understand it. So I'd love to hear you talk about these three goals, how they're different, what they are, and any similarities or differences you see between them, with the ultimate goal of trying to get to this question of what is the goal of theater? And I know there's lots of goals of theater, but fundamentally, like, I want to talk about me. I want to talk about the theater that I want to write the next 30 years. And I'm incredibly fascinated by this idea of what the goal of theater is, what the goal of my plays should be, what the goal of the next new exciting round of plays could be. Because I also feel like, you know, so-called Eastern thought is very new for this part of the world that we live in and grew up in. And as much as I have read and trained and studied all the Greeks and all the Shakespeare's and all the Ibsen's and all the, you know, the Western tradition of theater, now you have all this Eastern tradition and they're slamming together and it's changing theater. And we're, you know, it's a more hybridized, unified intellectual world now. And what is the goal of theater now that Eastern thought is so, in a sense, the predominant thought, I would say, like, you know, as much as Shakespeare's plays, for instance, came out of real Christian Europe, and the Greek plays obviously came out of, you know, an Olympic cosmology and a Greek city-state mindset. Our plays now are coming out of what I almost feel is a very newly Easternized metaphysic and cosmology. So I want to. So that's my question. What are those goals? How do they line up? What kind of similarities and differences do you see in them? And what is the goal of theater? There you go.
Yeah. Good question. But in the play last night, the Hamlet last night, that Hamlet was done. It had six actors for one woman and the rest men. And when the play within a play was done, this Hamlet in his fat suits danced across the stage many times, saying, theater is horrible. We hate it. It's sad. The shitty theater. We love it. We adore it. We worship it. I mean, because, you know, I said anything I say is false, because one thing is, I think, the beauty of the theater, of the opera, the dance, maybe, is that it leaves you speechless. When it's good, it leaves you speechless. And I think, I think that this word Buddhism, this word Buddha means awake, you know, it's awake. And I think that what I was saying before about life, that to be awake to this fact, to the fact of life, we don't know what it is. We don't know even what we're seeing, because although in this popular mindfulness, they're always saying, you know, you have to see things as they are and you have to be aware of things as you are. of course, it's all happening in your brain or something, in your nervous system. It's throwing up a picture that we then we say, oh, I'm really looking at what's really real out there. But really, it's referring back. So what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say I think it's a cartoon, but in these traditional forms of art in India, the discipline is very high. You practice all day long. I took Al Bendit and I, one year we took, or maybe it was somebody else, maybe it was Aaron. I think it was Al. We took a Kathak class. It was Al and I. Kathak dance class for a summer at Portland State University. Kathak dance, it's a kind of a barefoot tap dancing in which all the incredible rhythms of the Hindu ragas and all that are beaten out with the feet. It's an astonishing kind of form. And the person might be dancing with their upper body. They might be playing Lord Krishna or different things with their upper body. But their feet are beating out these incredibly complicated and intense rhythms. And so in this class, I think there were probably 20 or 30 people in this class, and this question came up, you know, do you practice yoga, to this guy? And this guy said, you practice Kathak, you know, 8 hours a day, and you don't have to practice yoga because you're doing, you know, you're breathing, your mind, your concentration, everything is done in the practice of this form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We practiced all summer this little dance, and at the end of the summer, he gave a performance, and this little dance that we'd been practicing all summer in the class represented about 1 second of the dance. The evening of dance that he did. So where am I going? This is being recorded. there's what I think is in that Indian tradition, it's connected to Indian shamanism. In Indian tradition, there's trance, in which the idea of yoga, of becoming one with God and all of that is described in terms of trance, in terms of, in the performance, it also is in shamanism in a very real way, where you become embodied by the God. So you're playing Krishna. Krishna takes over your body, and you become Krishna, which is not doesn't take away 20 years of detailed technical mastery. So
are you? Go ahead.
If you go back to the myth of the Buddha. In the mythical story of the Buddha, he did all these things as a child. You know, these were child's play to him. He could go into any trances. He could do any. I'm running out of battery here, so I have to go to space to plug in. So, and then in that myth, he goes to all the big yoga teachers of his day. And studies with him, and of course, he can do anything, you know. Immediately masters whatever it is that they're teaching, no problem. But it's unsatisfactory to him. It doesn't really answer the question to him. So he has to find something else. So what was your question? What was the goal? So... I don't know. I think it has to do with being awake and awake. It's what we see in actors. So it has to do with the embrace of the human. It has to do with survival, with being at the bone, and if I felt a little disappointed last night, it was because maybe because they had that idea, but they weren't there, and because they weren't there quite, it would have been more awakening to hear the text of Shakespeare's play spoken than all this playing around, which sometimes was fantastic, but you know what I'm saying? So I think
Go ahead.
I don't know what I'm saying, man.
No, it's beautiful. No, you're
if I hear this.
Oh no. You're doing great. You're gonna hear this and you're gonna be embarrassed, but you're doing great. We're all gonna be embarrassed by your mastery. Theater wakes you up, watching theater wakes you up. In the same way that Chisholm does?
Yeah, I think it's a meeting. I think theater means the seeing place, right? I think that's what it originally meant. It's a meeting. It's where television, as good as the writing might be now and stuff, you know, blah, 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 you're sitting alone. It's the palest kind of relationship to the actors and other people watching, and movies, a little bit more depth to it if you go to a theater and watch a movie. But in the theater, you're actually in the same room with the performance. And in a good play, you don't know what's going to happen. Really, even if it's a play that's been running for 400 years, and you've seen 400 productions of it, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know, and you're gonna. So you're alert. Your senses are alert. I told you before that my friend Alex Kay said, when you go to a Bromley play, you realize you've been walking around asleep, and your brain has to wake up, catch up, you know, listen, connect, and. And that's a quality of great writing, but also a quality of great acting. Is I got to catch up with these guys. These guys,
yes,
are feeling. Hamlet says it about the player kings talking to Jesus. Isn't it monstrous that this player here, in a fiction, in a dream of passion, can force his soul to his own deceit, tears in his eyes. Distraction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what would he do if he had the I can't remember the word, but if what would this guy do if he had the cue for action that I have? Why, he would drown the stage with tears. Yeah.
Yes.
So Hamlet is in that scene being the ideal audience. He's like saying, "My God, this guy is crying over Hecuba."
Yeah. What's Hecuba to him?
So I think that's it's a meeting, and it's a meeting in a community. It's a meeting of a whole community in which we all come out of there, but maybe when we get outside the door, we don't want to look at each other even. Or maybe we do. Maybe we really do want to give loving looks, because we know that this is my story as well as.
Yeah.
This is what it means to be a human.
Yeah. But actors and playing a role on stage do represent kind of an enlightened being, I guess, or a model being, or an awakened, a more awakened being that we emulate with, we aspire to. We watch them and they do every little micro thing, and we think, oh, you know, if only I had the programming and the muscle and the ambition and the energy and the consciousness to be so on, what a wonderful life this would be, right? So they offer us a view of living at a certain level that is not necessarily easy to do in the everyday, right? Day after day after day, right?
Well, it's been drummed out of us.
Yeah.
We have to admit that.
Yes. And also, you know, it's like, it's also, you know, it could take me years to write a play, working 3 hours a day, every day. And I end up with 2.5 hours of text. And then people get up and they speak it. And it seems like such an altered reality and such a dense, spectacular, higher level and frequency of communication and thought. But of course, it's an incredibly condensed drop of mind, right? It's a million thoughts per ounce because it's just been so condensed. And then the actor takes it and is like giving this hyper pure and hyper strong sauce to people. And, you know, it's not real, obviously, in the sense that, you know, life couldn't be that magnanimous and elevated, or maybe it could be, but it's not. So it sounds like one goal of theater is to whip people up. Not necessarily to anything in particular, not to a particular morality or a particular idea or a particular mandate, but to just provide them with a wonderful, wild, true, dense, brilliant way of living and thinking and feeling that they then kind of charges their battery, I guess. And that is a similarity between theater and, say, going to the Zendo and listening to a talk or sitting between the poles or entangling your eyebrows with those of the patriarch by having insights. So there's a similarity there, isn't there?
Yeah, I feel it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I feel like that in each field, maybe, but particularly in the religious field, people are going to put their own thing at the height of, there's a hierarchy and their thing is at the top of the hierarchy, whatever it is. But to me, when an actor has an insight, when you're working with an actor in a scene, and when they have an insight as to what it is, it doesn't get any better than that. You know, that's
to be there when they have it, or to help them have it, or to have it yourself. Yeah.
Insight is insight. Freedom is freedom. You know, the freedom, the goal of freedom is more freedom in a way.
Yeah.
And yeah. So it's not, I would say it's not like it. It's the same thing to me. It's the same thing. And so the yoga, I mean, you know, maybe I had this stew about this for a few years, and I directed in Portland, taught a lot of classes, all that. I read, I mean, they have all this stuff going on that we'll have in New York, so I had to kind of make it up from what I was reading, reviews and reading plays and stuff, thinking about it. So maybe I don't know anymore how much time I spent trying to figure it out, but at the end of the day, I think it's not different. It's the same. It's the same. Yoga is the same to me as sitting, and sitting is the same as dancing, and the Feldenkrais that I do is the same. It's and it's not it's the same in that it's like having a tiger pursue you. It's the same in that it's an alertness and awareness. What you said, you're not always being pursued by a tiger, and life would be horrible. I mean, some people's lives are like that, I think. In Ukraine right now, or Serbia, places. So that's, you can't live like that. It just destroys you. But to have that on tap, as it were, and also to sleep and dream and rest and have sex, dance and eat good food, all that is also, there's also a path of being awake.
Yeah, good. Yeah. 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 That's wonderful. Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, okay. I think I'm going to call it. I think my wife wants me to come help with the baby, which I think is an excellent request. That was a beautiful. Yeah. That was what I wanted to talk about today. And thank you for being. Thank you for talking. And I think what you said was amazing. And there's much more. I have many more questions, but thank you so much, Howard.
Thank you.
It's lovely to see you.
Yeah, yeah, it's lovely to see you too.
Yeah,
I feel like I talk so much, and I will be so humiliated if I listen to it. But it's wonderful to be with you in this form, in any form that I can be with you in.
Well, we'll have you. We'll and then maybe the next time we'll have you listen to yourself and talk about the experience of humiliation and what that is. Yeah. That was great. Thank you so much, Howard.
Okay, dear.
I love you. I'll talk to you soon.
Love you too, and love to Leah and Easy.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Bye bye.
So I decided to close this second conversation with Howard with a song called Last of Our Kind. This is off our first album. And it kind of describes two people who are on the run and know that they are due to die at the hands of people who are taking things over. The couple who is due to die are real sort of wanderers and nature lovers and outback explorers, and they see the sort of loss of their beloved spaces and know that they too are going to be brought down soon by the machines that hack things to bits. And I chose it because I think of Howard as a little bit of a kind of a last of his kind. I don't know. It's kind of, Howard's one of those sort of like, they don't make them like that anymore, people. You just, there's something so, so rich and inscrutable and legendary and laden with wisdom about him. It's a truly beautiful thing to be around. So this is a song, Last of Our Kind, by The Good Heart off our first album.
We don't mind, 'cause we love it all the time.
This has been the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirkwood Bromley. For more information, visit inversetheater.org.